La vida suele ponerse confusa. Sigue tu intuición, escucha tu cuerpo, vive en el presente, todo está en la mente. Llena de contrastes, instrucciones, contradicciones y de tantas cosas que no tienen sentido. Yo soy Cristinona, tu host, y esto es Intuition Podcast, un espacio para reírnos, llorar, cuestionar, conectar. Lo único que tiene que hacer sentido es que nada realmente hace sentido. ¡Let's do this, bitch!
Hello, hello, Viet. Welcome to Intuition Podcast. It's a pleasure having you here.
Thanks, Christina. So good to be together.
I was just saying that this is my first English-speaking episode on the podcast, so I'm very excited.
So cool. I feel very honored. Thank you.
Of course. Well, my first question for you is, who is Viet? I say that we have our roles and we have our soul. So roles are all the labels that identify us. And then soul is how the adjectives that we describe who we are beyond what we do. So I would love if you could describe yourself first. What are your roles? And then how would you describe your soul?
You know, I am very blessed to have these things be moderately synonymous in a sense, right? Because my work in the world is very much a pleasurish dance with the outer space, celestial oneness that is all things, all beings. So I'll just spitfire both of those things. And I think that I'm a blend of both of those things. So awesome. I am a famous spiritual teacher. I work with incredible people all around the world. I guide huge meditations that I score with my own music. I've been written up in every magazine and blah, blah, blah. I have a best-selling book. And in terms of my soul is, you know, I'm someone who's been blessed with a very, very tragic life, but filled with such great and immense love and culture and spirituality from a very early start. I was raised by an awakened shaman in New York City. So I have this rough and rumble kind of rough spiritual side, you know, and cups of tea and gazing into each other's eyes and fireplaces and lots of drugs in my story, and then leading to overcoming heroin addiction and becoming sober. And being sober for 14 years, coming on 15 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. But again, like these are all my, you said personality self, right? This is all personality self. What I can say is that I've had the blessing to see the other side. And at first I saw the other side by being a child, being raised by an awakened teacher. And then I saw the other side by taking massive amounts of hallucinogens and drugs and heroin and cocaine and you name it. And now, coming on 15 years sober, I've seen the other side through breath work, meditation, through somatic work, through dance, through making love, through creating a career of my wildest dreams, marrying the man of my dreams, making babies. So everything I do in the world is, you know, leaking into this other side. And that's what I do today, is I help private clients and huge events of people to see what it is to merge the worlds of commerce and reality and film and Hollywood and all the blitz and glamour of reality with this cosmic consciousness that most people only get when they, you know, go off into outer space in a spaceship or something, or trip on ayahuasca. And to me, I help people how to connect those worlds.
That's amazing. I've been pondering a lot on my definition of success, especially coming from a business and entrepreneurship school in college. And I like to define the definition of success as aligning your souls and your roles too, and having a blend of each other. I think that there's nothing more rewarding or fulfilling than being able to make a career out of your soul, right?
Yes. Well, anything else is kind of subpar, because again, we want as much contact with that other side as we can get on this planet. This planet is designed to put us to sleep. This body is designed to put us to sleep. And so every morning we wake up and it's the same dance. It's not like, oh, well, I found enlightenment 7 years ago, and so now I'm just like fucking easy street. No, every day I wake up And the fact that I found enlightenment, it means, okay, great. That means I have to do 7,000 things today so that I can combat the giant wave that is unconsciousness. And as it dances towards me and seduces me back into its arms, and I say, fuck, here you are again. You know, it's like, it's not in.
I love how you define enlightenment and have redefined it throughout your life. Before we get into enlightenment, I wanted to share, I've shared this with you before, but I've also been blessed with a lot of tragedies. And during my last one, last year, when I was in my depressive episode, I would listen to the lunar. I mean, ever since I found you, I think I found you via Lisa around 2019. I've listened to the lunar every time I'm super sad and I feel that I can't keep going. And last year, when I really, really, truly thought I couldn't keep going, I would still listen to the lunar in bed. And I was wondering, how does that make you feel?
That makes me feel so happy, because I've been so sad too. And I think it's, you know, many of the times when I've been sad before, I've wondered, why would God or the universe give me so much sadness? And one of the reasons that came to me is because of the music that comes through me. And music comes through sadness, you know, like the, you know, Mozart's Requiem didn't come through the wings of success and happiness. Mozart wrote that while he was dying of the plague. And so I really think it's important to remember that we've been given these scars, these wounds, this pain, and there's a reason for all of it. It's not accidental. It's not like, oh, well, fuck, we fucked up on Biette, you know, and Christina. We gave them a little bit too much depression or too much this. No, like, it's our job to alchemize that. So that's beautiful. I'm so glad that we were able to grieve together through those songs.
Yeah, I would think if she could do it, I can too. That was like my motor. And that's why I'm so excited to get a chance to speak with you, because I look at you and your life and I think, wow, how can you still show up every day with this eagerness to continue spreading the universe's message? Where do you get all your strength?
Well, today I get it from the fact that I don't think there's a difference between those two things. You know, there was a time when I felt like I was at war with that sadness. And I felt, well, one day if I just become rich enough or enlightened enough or skinny enough or pretty enough or whatever enough, then it'll stop. And as I became richer and more famous and more successful and more married and more whatever the hell I wanted, I realized it's not going anywhere, and it's my joy. And so today I feel like my sadness comes to me, my doubts come to me, my agony comes to me, you know, sometimes in the face of just like missing my mom or missing my baby or, you know, something, it'll be like an agony will strike me. Or it could just be something today, like I get an email where I lost something or got rejected or I'm sad about something that's happening right in the moment. But today I look at those things and I see them as opportunities. Like, it's as if someone's giving me paint and I can take the paint and I can turn it into a painting, or I can just like lay there covered in paint. Like, there's a choice of what you do, but like the materials are being given, and I see pain as a material today that I get to do things with. So it feels very privileged. I feel very privileged in the same way that I do when someone gives me, you know, like $1 million. I'm like, yay, $1 million. Now I feel that way about pain as well. And so both, but I'm a big fan of both.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing. My question for you is, how do you manage to not get attached to past versions of you or not make your tragedies a part of your identity if you talk about them often as a part of your job?
You know, it's interesting because it is a part of my personality self. Oh, Biette, she is this survivor of losing her mother, losing her whole family, losing her daughter to sudden infant death syndrome, overcoming heroin addiction. And so when I share this stuff, I share it from a place of the yearning to connect with other people's hearts. I say it like, okay, well, my heart's been broken. Hey, you. Your heart's been broken. Cool. Like, we can jive now. I say it as an open invitation so people can feel safe with me, not as a way to relive, you know, my pain or to like re whatever, woe is me. I don't feel like a victim of those things today. I feel more like, again, it's my connection piece. Those are my wounds. It's why I make amazing music. It's why I write great books. This is why. And also, if I never feel any more giant tragedies in this life, like if my last tragedy for this life, which holy moly, God, please give it to me, is death. If that's the only thing I've got left, which I would love. Thank you so much, whoever's taken my order. Then, you know, like, that's okay, because I actually know how to find enlightenment without those tragedies today. Mm-hmm. I've done enough shock for shock that I know how to create daily shocks today that don't involve me needing, you know, the World Trade Center to come crashing down for me to find that, you know.
For sure. So going back to the enlightenment piece, one of the things I admire most about your work is how you've redefined it as not this one-time thing, but continuous thing. So I would love if you could speak more about how you define it and how you see it today and how it's evolved throughout your life.
Yeah, I am here to help the world to see a new definition of enlightenment. And I do think that that definition is more feminine than the one that we've been handed down. You know, we've been handed down this definition that's like, you find it, once you find it, you see the white light. And then from that moment on, you're just better than everybody else. You're not touched by the same fears. Like when you see things go wrong, you're above it immediately. You just think to yourself, wow, remember that time when I was someone who cared about those types of trivial things like war and famine and sadness and cancer? Oh, so nice that I'm enlightened now and no longer feel any connection to those things. No, like that never happened. And so like I actually sought to find that, and I really wanted to be the one, because again, it's a winning game. That masculine definition of enlightenment is one where someone wins, and it's a competitive game where it's like, oh, how much enlightenment you got? Well, I've got enough that I don't care about anything. I don't care about shit. Like I am free from desire, you know? And so like, first of all, I'm a fourth way teacher. So never in fourth way does it say you'll be free from desire, but I still wanted that. I still wanted to be like free from the noise, you know? And so as I kept having white light experience after white light experience, mind you, completely sober. I've had completely sober white light experiences. And inside of those white light experiences, I was like, it's happening. It's finally happening. And I would cry and I would listen to my record and be like, everybody's gonna be connected and blah, 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 blah. And then nothing. Like a week later, I had the same issues and the same doubts and the same fears that I had prior to having the white light experience. And so after years of this, I finally started to realize, well, maybe that's not it. Maybe the enlightenment isn't this. And if I keep looking for it to be this one thing that it never has been, I'm going to keep getting disappointed. And I'm really not a big fan of disappointment. So as I went towards it, I started learning new modalities to incorporate into the Guided by Beat practice. Some of them involved grieving, some of them involved movement, some of them involved breath work, and all of them led me to this wheel. My friend Arjuna did this research study where he researched brilliant people, and he researched them, and they all did things a similar way. They had a similar way of going. And when I looked at his chart about brilliance, I saw it as, oh, this is actually my definition of enlightenment. My definition of enlightenment is a wheel. And inside that wheel, there's like enlightenment, which is that white light experience where you remember who you are and you're like, oh my God, I'm the best ever, blah, blah, blah. But then that goes to 3 o'clock, which is like creative flow, where you start a podcast or you write a book or you record a record or you travel to Thailand, like whatever you're doing stuff, it's creative. And then you go to 6 o'clock, and 6 o'clock is ambition. And that usually people don't tie that to enlightenment. In fact, they see it as antithetical. But the truth is, for me, is like, if I can't pursue a Grammy and an Oscar while I'm pursuing enlightenment on this planet, what am I even doing here? You know, why are we all so excited about people who've done great things on the planet if we don't care? Oh, I'm just above all that. I was recently talking to a friend who was like, he's trying something new with his career, and he stopped everything he was doing just to tell me, well, just so you know, Beat, I don't really care about this going anywhere. I'm just doing it for fun. And I was just like, okay, I'm like, whatever you say, buddy. Like, but in my mind, I'm like, That is such bullshit, friend. You want it just like I want it. We all want it. We have this deep, juicy hunger to succeed and create big things and cause ripples and make love. Like I love making love to my husband, but with my work, with my music and with my books and with my lectures and with my experiences, I want to have fucking sex with millions of people. And I'm not going to be satisfied if it's like, oh, well, it was just like a couple people or whatever, but oh, now I'm dead. Whatever. I tried, you know, I'm going to try. I'm going to fucking try. I'm going to try. I'm going to try. And every time I fail, which I fail all the time, I'm going to get up and try again. So then we get to 9 o'clock, which, and I'll be done with my definition. 9 o'clock is humility, where you realize you're a worthless piece of crap. Nothing you do matters. No one cares about you. No matter how hard you try, you keep failing. And everyone goes through that, no matter what, who you are. Even Arnold Schwarzenegger in the recent documentary about Arnold, who's, I don't think, ever failed at anything other than his marriage, but he's failed at, I mean, literally never failed at anything, this man, okay? And he said when he would look in the mirror, he would be like, you're disgusting. You're so fat and ugly. This is like the number one bodybuilder in the world at that time. So all is to say, 9 o'clock is like that, punch you in the gut feeling that pulls you to the ground and forces you to pray. And if you know what to do when 9 o'clock comes, you go down and you just say, please help me. Please, please help me. Please, please just help me. I don't know what the fuck is going on here. I don't know who you are. I don't know what this is, but please help me. I can't do this without you. And then something washes over you. You know, there's this, I think it was Teresa of Avila, who was an awakened being. And she said that when she prays, she just lets God love her. And that to me is like the most beautiful definition of prayer I've ever heard.
Wow. Well, I'm thinking about myself when I've had various deaths in life is how I call them. But the one I thought was the last one was when I fractured a vertebrae in my spine and I felt like I rebirthed and I started sharing my soul on Instagram and started living aligned. And I just felt like that was the last one in my eyes, right? I had lived several more before. And I got a depressive episode due to a severe inflammation in my brain due to COVID. And oh my God, I was so devastated. I felt like, shit, but I already rebirthed. Like, what is this? Right? I had felt that I had already been enlightened in the way. And one of the things that you say is that part of being enlightened is that you'll get several deaths again, right?
Yes. No, it just keeps coming. It's not about death or birth. It's like, it's going to keep coming. The denying force, the friction, this planet. And, you know, again, like I used to think that there was an end point. Okay, well, I don't want that anymore. What I want is, I don't know, just again, like I want immunity.
Yeah.
But how do you get immunity on a planet that is suffering? You are one with every single person on this planet, right? You're one with every single thing. You're one with the trees, with the ocean. You're one with the, you know, the climate change. You're one with the war that's happening right now in the Ukraine. You're one with the concentration camps in China. You're one with the people who are living on less than a dollar a day. You are one with everyone and the fish that just washed up in Texas, all dead on the ocean. You're one with them. So, okay, fine. Go buy a Bentley. Go become a world famous, successful fucking whatever. Go lose the weight. Create a perfect body. Go find the partner of your dreams. I don't give a fuck what you do. But at the end of the day, the horrible agony that is your humanity will always be a part of us. And what a gift. Like, why would I want to like, oh, I'm just better than that. Like, no, like it's happening. My heart needs to be open so that I can be connected to what's happening and connected to my brothers and sisters.
When you were saying why you share what you share and why you're an open book, this is what helps you connect with even people like me. I believe that we attract the people that, right? I feel that if you hadn't shared so vulnerably what you share, not with the purpose of reliving your tragedy, but with connecting with other beautiful souls, this is what makes you feel one.
Yeah.
My next question for you is, how have you trained your nervous system to be at ease with peace and calm after growing up with so much tragedy?
That's an endless, you know, journey. But I would say that I do daily exercises for that. And they do include touch, self-touch, movement, breath work, music. And, you know, I incorporate all of those things to create an effect. I'm actually having a course come out so people can buy little vignettes and try these things at home. You don't have to necessarily work with me one-to-one to experience these things. But that is another way. That is mostly how I do my work, is one-to-one with clients.
Yeah. Because one of the things I've been experiencing recently is this idea of waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm always constantly getting that anticipative anxiety of who's gonna die, like, is there gonna be an earthquake? Like, I get a call and I immediately assume something is gonna go wrong. I personally assume that you have been through that. Have you? And if so, how do you manage that?
Yeah, I still have that. I have that. Yeah, I just had it like last week or whatever. My baby died on her 4-month birthday, my first baby. And now my most recent baby, Sunday, she just turned 4 months a couple weeks ago. And, you know, it was very hard to just even to the date. Like, I take it very seriously. I have PTSD about it. The difference between me, and I want to say this because I posted about this on social and several people reached out to me saying, oh, well, I'm a therapist that helps with people with PTSD and I can help you. And I was thinking, I don't want help. I'm good. And I didn't mean that in like a cocky way. I just mean it like the deliciousness of my PTSD today is not a front to me. I am not at war with my PTSD. I embrace it. Okay. I'm scared today. Oh, it's her 4-month birthday. Oh, death is real. Oh, she may not make it through today. She could die. Okay. All right. What do I do with that? You know, and I have things that I can do with that. I can paint. I can do breath work. I can write a poem. I can write a song. I can do somatic work. I can do my signature practices, which I have designed just to feel. And most importantly, once I do all that work, generally what gets to happen is I get to weep. And I weep, and I weep for the baby that I lost. And I weep for how much I love this baby. You know what's the worst part? Okay, so I lost a baby, right? But anyone who's listening to this, I don't care if you've lost a baby, not lost a baby, like that baby, if you have a baby now, that baby's gonna die. The moment you had a child, that person was on their way to dying one day. And there's something very tragic about that and sweet and sad. And when I think about my first daughter, Cash, I sometimes visualize her as an old grandma dying on her deathbed. And I just go through that agony just to feel it, because it's like, I did that to her. I brought her here. I mean, I made love to the stars, and me and the stars and my husband together created this kid who's gonna fucking drop dead one day. That's tragic. And you don't need PTSD to know about that. Like, you could be a person who's been like walking in privilege your whole life, and all you have everything and, you know, 1,000 thread count sheets, and you live in fucking the Palisades, and your parents are rich, and you've never seen anyone die. I don't care if you have a kid or if you have a body, if you know people you love, every single one of you is going to drop dead. And no, not just one day, but at any moment. It could happen at any moment. It could happen like today. And I think we all know that, regardless of whether people want to admit it. And so to me, it's like, I welcome my PTSD today. I do not deny it. I also don't think I'm very special for it. I see myself as level and equal to all people like me. Okay, I got the privilege of getting it good, but it's like, all right. But anyone who's really present for it knows it's good. It's real here, you know, regardless of whether you've never seen it. It's coming.
Well, listening to you describe PTSD as delicious is truly admirable, and I think a breath of relief for a lot of people that have PTSD that can be able to honor it and embrace it in a different way. So thank you for that. Sure. Now that you've mentioned your children, I recently saw this quote that being a mother is being one of the greatest spiritual teachers out there. I wanted to see what are your thoughts on that.
I don't know. It's a real thing, being a mom. It's such a, I don't know. I have a 4-year-old and a 4-month-old. And as a mom to littles, I feel very good. I've heard that it's much more difficult when they're like teenagers or something, you know? So I have this story in my mind, like, oh, well, I guess we'll see, you know, that might be really difficult. But so far, I feel like it's just such an honor to behold, you know, little humans and to remember that they are their own being. They're going to do their own thing. And all I can do is model my fucking amazingness. That's it. That's my goal. That's my everyday when I wake up. It's like, I love the shit out of them. But my number one priority is that I dance with God in this life and that I live a life beyond my wildest dreams. Because at the end of the day, they're just going to copy me, you know?
Yeah, for sure. There's a difference between telling your children to follow their dreams constantly than embodying it, right? So that's amazing. Moving on to your body. I have connected with you through the fact that you've struggled with body dysmorphia and have had a complex relationship to your body, like most of us have, especially being a woman. So my question for you is, what tools or mindset shifts have served you most when healing your relationship to your body or continuously healing your relationship to your body?
God, I've done so much, you know, to be fair, it's like, wow, the specialness of that. I've done so much work. I studied intuitive eating for a long time, which really helped. And I would say that that softened me quite a bit. But ironically, on the other end of intuitive eating study, which I did for like 4 years, I think I thought, well, one day, if I just become like neutral enough about it, I'm just going to get a little bit bigger. And I'll be okay with that. Like, that's what I think I thought that on some level, you know, I was like, well, if I'm just going to eat whatever I feel, then I'm going to eat that grilled cheese, or I'm going to eat that mac and cheese, or I'm going to eat whatever, you know, and then just like love on myself. That was my thinking, like eventually that would happen. Mm-hmm. And it's super not what happened. What happened on the other side of years and years of intuitive eating was me feeling like I actually really wanted to learn about nutrition. And I wanted to embrace honoring nutrition. For me also, I'll speak to, my mom died when I was six, and she died very suddenly of pancreatic cancer. But right before she died, she spent my whole life eating health food and representing like wellness products. Like, she had like stuff that was big in the 80s. You know how there's like trendy products? So there was trendy products then, and she like repped them and like took them, and she drank all the stuff, and she made smoothies and soups, and we only shopped at the health food store. And so when she died, I think I connected in my own little six-year-old brain. Like, I was like, eating really healthy is dumb, because if you do it, you drop dead at 39 anyway. So might as well do heroin, drink vodka, and eat nachos, because shit, like, you're going to drop dead anytime they want you to. Might as well fucking eat shit. And so it's taken me, I'm 44 now, and it's taken me that long to be like, I don't care. I mean, there is like an internal PTSD fear that I'm going to get cancer if I eat well, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take this risk. I'm just going to study nutrition. I have a nutritionist. I'm studying different kinds of exercises, and I want to see, like, what can I do to like love the shit out of myself today? And the one thing that I found is my mantra before was, I'm a loser. And you know what? I'm not going to succeed when it comes to my body. Cause I don't care that much, cause I'm so smart and so spiritual. I just don't care that much about body. Body stuff is for dumb people, you know? And I would see people on the internet in bikinis. I'd be like, well, I guess if I was dumber, I would care that much about my body. Mm-hmm. And that was my like push off, right? But today I'm like, I don't care if people think I'm dumb. I don't care what people think. I'm going to pursue my wellness today. And that looks a specific way to me. And I get to do that. I get to pursue it. Not in a way that's going to be harmful. I'm not going to harm mm-hmm. myself. But in any way that I can, to naturally and lovingly nurture my body with food and exercise and breath work and healing and lymphatic drainage or whatever, I'm going to do those things.
Wow. Yeah. It's all about reframing how we look at it, because at some point when you have complex relationship to food, you stopped seeking, well, at least for me, I stopped seeking nutritious food because that would make me healthy, because my obsession to healthy food was what in my eyes was categorized as unhealthy. And then it's finding that middle ground between, yes, I do want to love the shit out of myself and I do want to nourish myself with abundantly nutritious food. So finding that middle ground between has been tricky for me, but not, yeah, it's a complex situation, but I love how you frame it that, yeah, you have this PTSD about eating healthy food and your mother passing away. But now while you're here, if you can love yourself in that way, in the form of nutritious food, you're going to choose to do it.
Yeah. And also finding alternatives. Like, I don't have to eat the tortilla chip that's made of garbage. I can choose a tortilla chip that's better for me. And quantities, you know, like there was a time in my life where it was like, if I'm eating a chip, I'm going to eat the bag. And that's just how it goes. And go fuck yourself, you know? And today it's kind of like, I'm going to take a little cup and I'm going to fill it with a few chips and I'm going to eat some. And if I still need more, I can go fill another cup, you know, if I need to. But the chances are is I don't fucking need a second cup of chips. Like, it really is a matter of listening and loving. And that was very hard for me for so many years, because I don't know whether it was because I truly hated myself, or was because I was truly hated God for killing my mother, or whether it was because I truly hated people who were thinner than me, even though they were stupid and I was smart. Like, whatever stories I had, like, I just really, I don't know, something loosened. And also calling it out, like saying it out loud. Oh, this was like before when I was sick, and I was sick this weekend. Like, when I was sick, I would like order like sandwiches and fries. Like, it was my time to like go dark, you know, because I was like, well, I'm sick. I feel like crap anyway. This is like God's vacation for me. Like, I'm just going to lay in bed and eat garbage, you know? And then reframing that and just being like, okay, I'm going to have bone broth and I'm going to have like really nutritious food in smaller quantities, because you don't really need that much when you're sick. It's just literally just laying around. And also like trying movement. I used to just like, when I was sick, I'd be like, I'm just laying here. Like, I'm dead. And then actually this time I was like, I'm going to try some movement. I'm just going to try it. It's going to kill me, you know?
There's this quote from another woman I admire that says, when you feel like shit, treat yourself like gold. Usually we do what you did in the past of like eating garbage when you feel bad, because you already feel bad. And that's when we need to feel it, to nourish ourselves and make us feel like gold. And usually when I'm sad, I mean, I grew up seeing movies of women like eating ice cream the day they break up and feeding themselves emotions that way. That like got stuck in me. But now when I'm feeling sad, I'm like, okay, my body's already having a hard time digesting emotions. Let me nourish it with easily digestible food so that can work in tandem, right?
Beautiful. Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's really backwards. But like you said, if you do the work, you can get to that place where it's not like, what?
For sure. For sure. So, given you've worked with celebrities, why do you think being a winner is so hard?
I don't think that's what makes it hard for celebrities. I think that like my celebrity clients love winning. You know, I love winning. They love winning. Happy for them, for their wins. I think that what isn't said is that while you're winning, you're also losing. Like, every single person I work with who's very, 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 very successful is still taking it. Right? It's not like, oh, well, once you have reached a certain level of success, you can like, you still take it. You still have like people, like, I remember one time, I'm a huge fan of Christopher Walken. I have no idea if you know who that is, or if anyone listening will know, because he's like an actor from the 80s, but he's just one of my favorite actors, right? And especially if you watch 80s films with him, he's just really special. And so I remember once I had a mentor and I said to him, I just want to be like Christopher Walken. You know what I mean? And my mentor was like this old, he was a stand-up comedian who'd become an Orthodox Jew and moved to Jerusalem. Like, he like converted to Judaism and moved to Jerusalem. Anyway, really eccentric guy. But he said to me, everyone has a Christopher Walken. Even Christopher Walken has a Christopher Walken, right? So it's like every celebrity that I work with, here's the thing, like they are in pain in the same way that you and I are in pain, or anyone is in pain. They are having struggles with their relationships in the same way that anyone struggles. They are lacking contact with the divine in the same way that anyone is lacking contact with the divine. And I remember for me, when I first started working with like A-list celebrities, there was this, what can I offer this person? Like that they have everything. They have an estate with like a gardener, like 17 gardeners, and they have like a private chef cooking like artisanal foods in the kitchen, and they have a beautiful family, and they have this gorgeous career, and they get to do whatever they want for a living. And I'm like, and they're gorgeous, and they have like, you know, the perfect face and whatever. And I would be like, what can I offer them? And I just remembered like when I was like 8, I had nothing. My mom had died. I was this depressed little girl living in Queens. And what I used to do was I would sneak out. I would collect money from all the kids in after school program. I would collect cash. And then I would sneak out of the school and I would go across the street and I would buy a bunch of chips, like different kinds of chips, onion rings, Doritos, corn chips, whatever. And then I would like bring them all back, sneak into the school, bring them all back. And I would create these beautiful ceremonies where everyone would get a plate and we would sit in a circle and I would like, we would all eat the chips like in and tell story. And I would tell these stories. I would make up all these lies. I was an amazing storyteller. I'd be like, last night when the alien ship came down and me and my friends were here, we came up with the aliens, but like, blah, blah, blah. And they were like, people believed my stories. They really were like, this girl like was here last night and the aliens had landed on the school property. You know what I mean? Anyway, my point is that even at 8 years old, I was already who I am today, which is someone who creates magic in people's lives. And I just remembered myself. I just remembered, I was like, look, Biette, you may not be the most famous person on the planet yet. You may not be a famous actor. You may not be the richest person on the planet yet. You may not be the richest actor. You may not be any of these things, but you are someone who creates magic in people's lives. And the way you see the world is different from how most people see it. So if you just be yourself in other people's presence, like it will do for them what it does for anyone else. And lo and behold, it did, and it was. And so I just, you know, more and more, I would invite, you know, famous people to work with me. And more, I just saw this, the truth over and over, that I have a magic. My magic is the same for famous people as it is for anybody else.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. One of the many things that I've loved about your work is when I started getting into the spiritual world, one of the beliefs I had to redefine was that rich people and spiritual people didn't go aligned. You know, you hear of Jesus and you hear of this person meditating in the Himalayas without much clothes and luxuries. And I've loved how you redefined that. I've heard you say that we can be meditating fourth way in the line of Barney's. So I would like if you could speak a little more about how has your relationship to luxury evolved, given that the time that you've collected food stamps for a living to being a world renowned meditation teacher and best-selling author. So how has that relationship to luxury evolved?
I think I just, you know, I understand that as somebody who had nothing, for me, it meant a lot to go to a place where I had a lot, you know, and it was a big shock to my system when I started being able to afford all these luxurious things. It took time to even be able to really do these things without a shock level. You know, there was like a shock, like, oh my God, I can't believe that this is me. I can't believe I'm shopping at this store. I can't believe I'm wearing those boots. I can't believe anything because I lived a life for so long of such extreme poverty that I didn't have those things. But at the end of the day, I would say that it was tapping into that everyone has these yearnings, you know, like I recently was working with a client who she was raised very rich. And so now she kind of goes the opposite way with a lot of things. Like she'll like wear like hippie rags and she goes out of her way to look kind of impoverished. And she likes things that are like not too fancy. And because she fetishizes poverty or some level of poverty, she associates with love, connection, warmth. So for all of us, we're looking for both things, I think. And I watched a film the other day. It was a film with Nicolas Cage from the 90s, I think, where he is this rich, rich, rich finance bro from like Wall Street. And he walks into like a bodega in the middle of the night and magic spell occurs and he goes back in time. And now he's married to the woman that he was with when he was in college. He never went to London. He never became a successful finance guy. And he's like working in a tire shop, but they have children and they like have this home and a dog and they live in Jersey. And for the first 2 weeks of him living in this situation, he thinks it's hell. Like he's gone from like driving a Ferrari and, you know, going to operas and like eating caviar to living with like a dog and like a bunch of children and like this shitty house and like Jersey, you know, and he's like, what is this? Like, F this. But after 2 weeks, he realizes that he has true love, that he's in love with this woman and he's in love with these kids and that like he'd rather be with them in poverty than go back and be all alone in his finance life. So then anyway, blah, blah, he goes back. The spell is broken after 2 weeks and he goes back to his lonely life as a finance guy, one of the richest men in the world. And he finds this woman and he says to her, like, I think we're supposed to be together. But here's my view, like as guided by Biette perspective, right? Like the thing, I don't know what the film is trying to say. Like maybe they're trying to say being impoverished in Jersey is like good enough as long as you have love. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like that's not good enough for me. Like I love that at the end of the film, he's still a finance guy and he takes his billions of dollars or whatever he's worth. And then he goes and finds the girl. I like the story where you get to have both. I think that's radical. I just think that's crazy. Mm-hmm. That takes so much balls, like to be like an Oprah, to be like, yeah, I'm black. And, you know, like I don't fit the mold in any way. And I'm going to just be like the richest, most powerful, most successful, most spiritual woman who's ever lived. Mm-hmm. Fuck you. Like, that's fucking cool. You know?
That is cool because the way I see it is now how I reframed it is being rich is one of the most spiritual acts you can be, because if you do it from the inside out, you are raising your vibration and therefore co-creating that abundance into your life in tandem with God. So that to me is as spiritual as it gets. I don't know what you think.
Yeah. And also it's architecture, right? So it's a matter of like, if you're rich enough, you can be philanthropic. If you're rich enough, you can build buildings and have them face oceans and then devote an entire floor of that to like a school. And then the little children will be sitting there like looking at the ocean, going to some conscious school. You did that. Like you can create, like in the same way that I can pick up a piece of paper and draw a little drawing, someone who has massive amounts of wealth can do a little piece of paper with a drawing with life. They can go like build a hospital and like fucking give it away for free to the community. Like you can do anything with money. It's
for sure.
Fun.
What are some things that you've done with money to fuel this collaboration to the world?
I mean, I've done on a small scale because I'm not that rich yet. So like I always give to charity when I can. And when I'm asked to do an event, like a philanthropic event, I'll go and I'll guide a meditation, you know, but I think my vision is much larger. My vision is to do very big things, especially around education. Like one of my visions is that personal development and meditation can be in schools, you know, because I just
that
feel
would be a game changer. If right? Only we had learned that in school.
Right? Like, if just why? Why can't it's such a simple little tweak, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I love that for you. We're almost to the end of the interview, but I have two more questions for you. The first one, well, you are famous meditation teacher. So what, and I assume this definition of meditation has shifted. There is the false belief that meditating, you have to be in a blank space and doing a similar work. I hear it again and again that in order to meditate, you have to see blank, a white blank space. And therefore, people give up meditating because they feel they can't achieve it. What do you have to say about that? How do you define it now? Has it changed through the years, how you've defined it?
No, I just think meditation is much more playful than that. You know, and you've read my book, like my book is all about finding different ways to meditate. And there's 44 ways to meditate in my book. And I feel like if you don't like any of those 44 ways, go fucking join, Vipassana and sit in silence for 10 days, or go learn Vedic and repeat a mantra over and over. Like there are so many methods. My method is one of like love and connection and touch and sorrow and grieving and you know, yumminess. Like sometimes For me, a prayer is just sitting in my kitchen and like cutting fruit on a cutting board. Like that's a prayer. It doesn't have to be so, you know, black and white, like, oh, I sat on a cushion, I did it like a robot, like that, you know. I think sometimes we just take it too, we take it too harsh. I do think it's important to take it seriously, but you can take anything seriously. You can take watching a firefly seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't just sit there.
Just sit there. Don't just sit there.
My last question for you, Viet, is I assume that I'm not the only person who looks at you for faith and hope in times of despair. So my question for you, what would you tell someone who feels that their heartache is so big that they just can't keep going? They want to give up on it all. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a bit harsh, you know, so like I would just be pretty harsh with people. Like I would just say, look, it's up to you. If you want to fucking end it all, it's pretty easy to, right? It's not hard to kill yourself or to do damage. But it takes much more courage to try to just not try, to just try different things, you know, and to pray. I would say pray. I would say get on your knees and beg. Beg the universe, beg God, whatever you want to call it. Say, please help me. I can't do this alone. Because the only reason somebody wants to end it all is because they feel completely alone. There's like, there's no way that there's a God inside of that, or there's no higher power inside of that. To me, when I remember what's really happening here, when I remember higher power, I feel so carried. And I take this giant book bag off my shoulders, which is filled with my responsibilities. How am I going to pay the bills? How am I going to become famous? How am I going to write a book? How am I going to, I don't know. I never did a thing in my life. I just took the book bag off. Once you take the book bag off, everything gets kind of done for you. But most of us are walking around with a giant book bag, just being like, I don't want to live anymore. It's so fucking heavy. It's like, just take it off. Give it to the universe. Like I was just in the ocean right before, this is why I'm like all wet. I was in the ocean. I live right by the ocean. And I was in the ocean and I was just like, I give you everything. You know, I was just giving it. And I was watching the waves. They're so big. You have no power over them. And in the same way, you have no power over the universe or God. You have no power. You're powerless. But if you remember that and you say like, I give you my body. I give you my sadness. I give you my tragedies. I give you my food shit, I give you my fucking doubts, I give you my financial fears, I give you my future, I give you my marriage, I give you everything. Just take it. And then you feel it like, whew, whew, just wow, like it's light. Okay, cool. Like I don't have to do much because God's got it. Like I just gave it to the ocean, you know?
Love it. And it's a beautiful metaphor for everything you're saying because God will literally take like the waves, everything for you too. At the end of the day, it's a co-creation. I love to say life is not painted in the stars or written in the stars. The universe co-writes it with you. So it's this beautiful dance of not everything is pre-written and preordained. You have a say in your life, but it's a co-creation. So it's something that's the way I like to see faith. I don't know how you would define faith.
I love your version that it's co-creative, you know, that we do it together, that we have to remember. I think faith is also just remembering all the time. It's remembering when things are in any, not looking outside yourself to remember.
I love it. Another person I admire says, it's the unseen order of things. Faith is the unseen order of things. That uncoincidental coincidences, right? Synchronicities. Like meeting you, which is a perfect wrap up to this interview. I am truly, truly honored to have you It's crazy how one encounter on Instagram, and that's why I love it so much. It's my window to the world. But one small encounter via Lisa. So shout out to Lisa. You have been there without even knowing through the hardest moments of my life. So getting to speak with you has been a true gift. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for being so magic yourself and sharing this with the world and doing your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gracias por escuchar este episodio de Intuition Podcast. Si te gustó y lo disfrutaste, me encantaría que lo compartieras en tus stories, ya sea vía Spotify o con un screenshot. Así este mensaje puede llegar a más personas como tú. O me puedes dejar un review en Apple Podcasts o wherever you get your favorite podcasts.